During the 20th century, there were three words which came into common use, all of them derived from the one Greek word. It was oikos, which means household or dwelling or home. Now, the rise to dominance of these three words reflects how we humans have become increasingly conscious of the fact that we live in a global home. The first word was ecumenical. It came from oikos by way of oikoumene, which means the whole world inhabited by humankind. The second word is economic. It comes from oikos, from its derivative oikonomia, which means the best way of ordering one's household affairs. And the third is ecological. Now, the word ecology was actually coined by a German zoologist, Ernst Haeckel. And he applied this word to the relation of the animal both to its organic and to its inorganic environment. So ecology deals with the organism and its home environment. It has been variously defined as the study of the interrelationships of organisms with their environment and with each other, or simply as the biology of ecosystems. Now, in the course of the 20th century, we became increasingly used to hearing these three words from oikos. In the first half of the century, the word ecumenical became widely used to describe the attempt by some Christians to re-establish the essential unity of the worldwide Christian church after it had become fragmented following the Protestant Reformation. Then, as a result of the phenomenon of globalization after World War II, economics asserted its importance in a way it hadn't done so before, as the art of understanding and managing the material affairs, first of our national household, and then of our global household, as in macroeconomics. It was only by the latter third of the 20th century that our growing awareness of the ecological character of all life on Earth awakened us to planetary crises which are already coming upon us. Crises which we humans have largely caused ourselves through our ignorance or our willful self-centeredness. Now, since St. Andrew's Trust was established to study the interaction between religion and society, this series of lectures has been planned to explore how our new understanding of ecology impacts on the Judeo-Christian tradition. To what extent, if any, does it require Christian thought and practice to undergo change? Well, as we shall find, this impact is so far-reaching that the theme of these lectures could well have been called the transition from theology to ecology. And we're starting today with the global crisis. Scientists, historians, and other commentators are warning us today of what may be called a global ecological crisis. This has the potential to be more devastating and more lasting than even that which might have resulted from a thermonuclear war. It could mean the end of all life on the planet. Now, the crisis they point to has been on the way for some time. But at first it was quite unobtrusive, not at all alarming. Only now is it accelerating. The first hint of it that I personally ever heard of it was when I was a rural parish minister in North Otago in the early 1940s. Farmers were being warned that improper use of their land was causing soil erosion, which could have disastrous effects long term. And I remember how some farmers took strong objection to being told what they could or could not do with their own land. Well, that turned out to be an early indication of how many humans react today as information comes to light of the more serious effects we humans are having on the very earth on which we depend for life. In 1962, a prophetic book was published by Rachel Carson. She was an aquatic biologist who had already established a worldwide reputation for her books on the sea. But today, she's chiefly remembered for one book, Silent Spring. It became a bestseller, and it is credited with creating a worldwide awareness of the dangers of environmental pollution. Yet, when she dared to suggest that synthetic pesticides were doing more harm than good, her book was dismissed by many as so much hogwash. She died in 1964, and she didn't live to see how her allegations were confirmed as legitimate, with the result that many pesticides now are banned and organic farming is spreading quite fast. During the last three decades of the 20th century, an ever-increasing number of books have been published warning that a frightening nemesis is now appearing on the horizon. They have such titles as The Fate of the Earth by Jonathan Schell, 1982, The Dream of the Earth by Thomas Berry, 1988, The Crisis of Life on Earth by Tim Radford, 1990, Earth in the Balance by no less a person than Al Gore, 1993, The Sacred Balance by David Suzuki, 1997, The Five Holocausts by Derek Wilson here in Wellington. Now, these modern secular prophets are alerting us to the early warning signals coming from a planet which is now feeling the pressure of the activities of the human species. What we may call the humanization of the Earth is actually leading to an imminent global crisis. Our species is now in the process of destroying in just a few decades what has taken millions of years to evolve. And some of these prophets are so pessimistic that they question whether it's actually possible for some 6 to 8 billion people to change the direction of our global life sufficiently in the relatively short time left in which to do it. Other prophets are more hopeful, and they see no reason why, with human ingenuity and further technology, we should not be able to reverse the dangerous policies we have already set in motion. So Jonathan Schell ends his book, The Fate of the Earth, by pointing to the choice which humankind must now make. A choice between a path that leads to planetary death and the path that leads to continuing life. And his words are very reminiscent of the ancient challenge found in the words of Moses. I have set before you this day life and good, death and evil. Therefore, choose life. But how many people are actually aware that today, on a global scale, we face a choice between life and death? the large masses of the earth's population are so caught up with what goes on in their own little world, they are as yet unaware of what the prophets are saying, let alone be in a position to do anything about it. A significant proportion of these people are in third world countries, Africa, India, South America. And they can be excused for their ignorance on the grounds that all of their energy and thinking is taken up with the need to scratch a living. Much more serious is the ignorance or apathy to be found in the first world. Because in the first world, it's our affluent lifestyles which are chiefly responsible for the crisis. And here most people are taken up with personal and local affairs of the moment that they remain largely unaware of the depth of the crisis. And it is here also that we find those vigorous critics who dismiss the prophetic voices as doom merchants, who grossly exaggerate the various signs and ignore the capacity of human ingenuity to respond positively to them. These critics are people, usually, whose wealth, business interests, and economic policies are dependent on the very technology currently doing the damage. So largely driven by self-interest, they appear to be shutting their eyes to the consequences of their own concerns. So what is it we should all be more aware of? Well, it really starts with the population explosion. It has been estimated that at the beginning of the Christian era, the human population of the planet was about 300 million. Population remained relatively stable, growing only slowly, so that by 1750, it was still only 800 million. And the reason is that disease, epidemics, famine, high mortality among children always took their toll. But those factors have now been drastically changed by such beneficial developments as medical science, education and personal hygiene, better sanitation, and improved economic conditions. Population growth began to accelerate from about 1750. By 1800, the world population had reached 1 billion, and it had taken some 2 million years to do it. But by only 1930, it had doubled to 2 billion, and a third billion was added by 1960, and a fourth billion by 1974. A fifth by 1990, and a sixth by 1998. During the 20th century, the human population of the earth quadrupled. Can you believe it? And all that in spite of the millions killed in the world wars or who died in the great epidemics. Now, present projections estimate that the global population will reach 8 billion by 2025. You see, we currently add the equivalent of another London every month and the equivalent of another China every 15 years. Of course, we see this expansion from the human point of view. But from the point of view of the other animals on this planet, the human species appears to have suddenly exploded like a plague of locusts, eating them out of house and home. Now, since the size of the planet remains the same, the increase in population forces people to live more closely together. Until 1900, the vast majority of the world's population lived in small rural communities. The proportion now living in cities has increased dramatically. In 1950, it was still a less than a third. By 2000, it had already reached a half. And this trend means that much fewer people now have first-hand experience of the land and the way it produces our food. So that fact, coupled with the rapid process of globalization, means that we humans are becoming increasingly dependent upon one another for our well-being, our basic sustenance, and therefore any upset has much more far-reaching and disastrous ramifications. Now, until the 1950s, the debate about human numbers remained largely academic. So when artificial forms of contraception were coming into common use in the first half of the 20th century, some people vigorously opposed them on religious grounds, regarding it to be primarily a matter of personal morality. But now that the global population is reaching the limits of sustainability, contraception has become a serious social concern, as well as a personal one. So the Roman Catholic rejection of all artificial forms of contraception and the still widespread moral condemnation of clinical abortion shows that traditional morality is sadly out of touch with the real moral problems of today. The population explosion is also drastically altering the racial composition of the world's population. For example, in 1950, the population of Africa was only half that of Europe. But by 2025, it will be three times that of Europe. By the year 2025, Nigeria's population could jump from 113 to 300 million. Kenya's from 25 to 77 million. Tanzania's from 27 to 84 million. Zaire's from 36 to 99 million. And that means that the nations that are already economically poor, and in many cases saddled with international debt, will have to bear the burden of feeding between two and three times as many mouths as they do at present. And that fact is setting the scene for a pandemic of unthinkable proportions. Now, a massive rise in population means a gigantic increase of the demands that we are making on the earth in order to sustain ourselves with the necessities of life. Water, food, clothing, housing. Modern agricultural science, coupled with new technology, has enabled us greatly to increase food production. And that's the positive side. Indeed, the affluent countries have never been so well fed. But the great imbalance in wealth, has meant that there is increasing hunger in the third world countries, mostly the very countries in which the population is expanding fastest. Now, perhaps with more willingness to share the fruits of the earth and more efficient means of distributing food, we could feed the present global population adequately. And that is an argument that is continually being promoted, but which shows no signs of coming to fulfillment. And even this argument would soon become invalid if we do not find a means of stabilizing the population. Now, increasing the food production to meet the demands of an expanding population has some very serious flow-on effects. Effects which, cumulatively, can spell disaster on the grand scale. And to make the point quickly, and not to burden you with too much detail, I shall present this chain of causes in a somewhat simplistic manner. To meet the basic needs of an expanding population, we must increase the food supply. To increase the food supply, agricultural science has come to depend on artificial manures and pesticides, some of which are already showing negative side effects. For the expanding population, we must build more cities. To build more cities, we must gobble up valuable agricultural land. To replace the land thus lost, as well as breaking in even more agricultural land to meet increased food requirements, we destroy the forests, the Amazon forest being the chief example. The Earth's forests, by the way, are shrinking at the rate of 17 million hectares per year. By destroying the rainforests and other surface vegetation, we are losing productive land by allowing millions of tons of topsoil to wash into the sea. The United States alone is said to lose 4 to 6 billion tons annually. But the rainforests, by absorbing carbon dioxide and releasing oxygen, have been instrumental in keeping in balance the atmospheric gases necessary for life. The amount of carbon dioxide coming into the atmosphere as a result of our increased burning of fossil fuels since the Industrial Revolution is now causing the phenomenon of global warming. Global warming is changing our weather patterns, bringing extremes of both storms and droughts, which in turn cause serious loss of our regular harvests. Global warming will soon cause the ice caps to melt and the sea levels to rise, endangering the homes of all those who live near sea level. Some of our inventions and activities have had the effect of depleting the ozone layer, which protects us from the harmful effects of the sun's radiation. And this not only increases the incidence of malignant cancers, but can also bring about unforeseen genetic changes. Now, it's only during the 20th century that human factors, such as the population explosion and human technology, have become sufficiently magnified as to be comparable with natural forces. And together, they are now sufficient to change the natural conditions of the surface of the planet. We are not only causing the extinction of many other species by destroying their natural habitats, we are even endangering our own habitat by polluting air and water, the two most basic commodities on which human existence depends. Now, the chain of causes linking all of these unfortunate facts together is an example of the interconnectedness of all life on this planet. And it vividly portrays why we had to create the new term ecology. We are coming to have quite a new understanding of how life works on this planet. So much so that the term biosphere, coined less than a century ago, has now to be replaced by ecosphere. Now, just as we have come to understand each organism internally as a complex living system, so that each species of organism also constitutes a living system with its environment. We could call it a life field. So all forms of planetary life are involved in and dependent on systems. The ecosphere is a complex system of systems within systems. Even the ecosphere of the Earth is itself dependent on the energy drawn from the sun. Now, the continuing life of each species depends on the preservation of a delicate balance that has evolved over time between the organism and the environment that supports it. Each organism contains self-regulating mechanisms that help to preserve that balance. We can understand this best by thinking of the organism we know best, the human being. Now, we had long been used to thinking of ourselves as wholes rather than as aggregations of parts. And it is only modern physiology that has fully identified the various organs and glands and immune systems that exist within the human body and promote and preserve its well-being. And when one or more of these systems has its balance disturbed and can no longer function, as say in diabetes, our health, that is, our wholeness, suffers. We become ill. And if the balance is not restored, we die. Now, the earth has provided certain basic conditions that must be met by all earthly creatures if they are to survive as a species. And humans also have evolved within these same parameters. Our respiratory system fits both the nature and the proportions of the gases in the atmosphere. Our bodies, which are 80% water, fit the Earth's water supply. The ozone layer protects us from the sun's harmful radioactivity. Our muscles and bone structure have evolved to meet the conditions of the Earth's mass. For humans to be healthy, we must be able to breathe fresh air, drink clean water, eat adequate food, and live in an environment not too different from that in which we became human. We must even keep to a diet not too different from that which our ancestors have been accustomed to for thousands of years. But the more the environment changes from that in which a species has evolved, the more the health and behaviour of that species will show maladjustment. Its health will deteriorate to the point where it will die. We humans will always be earthlings, along with all other earthly creatures. Our existence remains earth-related. Now, the fast-increasing human population has not only put added strain on the natural resources of the earth, but more seriously, it has upset the ecological balance between various species and their source of sustenance. We humans are interfering with the food chains that have evolved over time. And we are depriving many other creatures of sustenance to the point where we also eventually will suffer a similar fate. All food for human consumption, and for many other species as well, comes either directly or indirectly from four ecological systems: croplands, grasslands, forests, and fisheries. And each of these is being seriously depleted at the same time as the human population is rapidly growing. In 1992, 1,575 distinguished scientists, including more than half of all the living Nobel laureates, signed a document warning humanity that Western civilization will be at stake in the foreseeable future. They appealed for help from industries, businesses, and religions. During the last 4 years, 1,300 scientists from 95 countries have produced a report entitled Millennium Ecosystems Assessment. It finds that the human race has drawn so heavily on the Earth's natural resources during the last 50 years that the planet is now seriously overdrawn, leaving for our descendants an environmental debt of astronomic proportions. Well, How is Christianity to respond to the global ecological crisis? After all, has not Christianity always claimed to be concerned with the salvation of humankind? Well, those are the questions we must now explore. And by a rather odd coincidence, we find that the idea of an imminent global catastrophe is not at all new to Christianity. On the contrary, such an expectation actually permeates the New Testament. In his earliest letters, Paul referred to the imminent coming of wide and sudden destruction. It would come without warning like a thief in the night, he said. You see, the early Christians believed that the world would come to an end in their own lifetime, and they referred to it as the eschaton, the end time. And the Christian gospel was originally preached as the answer to that dire threat. Isn't it odd? Paul and others declared that in the last days, when this global catastrophe struck, Jesus Christ would return in glory and establish his everlasting kingdom, and only those who responded to the gospel would be saved. Now, some current New Testament scholars have cast doubt on whether this concern with the end time was actually part of the original teaching of Jesus. But even if it wasn't, it certainly played a prominent role in Christianity from Paul onwards, and it may well have been one of the factors which assisted the rapid spread of Christianity in the first century. The first three Gospels, written some 20 to 50 years after Paul, placed the warning of the coming eschaton very prominently in the mouth of Jesus. In Mark, we find Jesus warning of the tribulation shortly to come. It would be on such a scale as had never been known since the beginning of time. The sun would be darkened, the moon would lose its light, the stars would fall from the sky, and heaven and earth would pass away. And in Luke, Jesus is said to have likened the imminent crisis to the great flood, which wiped out nearly all of planetary life in the time of Noah. Now, once this expectation of a world crisis became incorporated into the Gospels, and these were later raised to the status of Holy Writ, it became a permanent part of the Christian tradition. Of course, Christian interest in it has rather waxed and waned during the centuries, and even St. John's Gospel, written at the end of the first century, seems to have bypassed it. Indeed, some scholars regard this last gospel as a fresh interpretation of the Christian message once that first wave of expectation had died away. And one scholar has actually called that gospel realized eschatology. And by that he meant that the gospel's assumption was that the eschaton had now come, but not quite in the way that was expected. Jesus had returned, but he had returned spiritually in the life of the church. Read the gospel in that light, and it's very interesting. But even if that were the fourth gospel's intention, it could not, of course, erase the earlier convictions of an imminent end time, because these remained in the three gospels, and they were subsequently spelt out in the creeds. So that fact in itself was enough to ensure that from time to time throughout Christian history, there has been a resurgence of this eschatological expectation. In the 19th century, the many Protestant sects that arose on the basis of biblical literalism nearly all made much of the imminent return of Jesus. The Jehovah's Witnesses still make much of it. The Seventh-day Adventists even included it in their very name, Advent. Curiously enough, when the modern method of studying the Bible emerged a little over 200 years ago, scholars at first took very little notice of this eschatological element, and it was not until a century later that Johannes Weiss followed by Albert Schweitzer, alerted biblical scholars to it, and it became known thereafter as the eschatological strand of the New Testament. And it came as a very severe jolt to the liberal theologians of the day, because they found it very difficult to reconcile that with much traditional theology, to say nothing of modern religious thought. Because the division of academic theology known as eschatology had long focused exclusively on the eternal destiny of the individual after death, rather than on the destiny of the earth. So generally speaking, therefore, theologians at the beginning of the 20th century concluded that these eschatological expectations were all part of the mythical thinking of the ancient world that had now become outmoded. But that does not satisfy fundamentalists and all who read the Bible literally. They take the New Testament references to the last days very seriously. And that is why fundamentalism, as it has spread in the 20th century and is now coming into the mainline churches, in it we find the most widespread manifestation of end-of-world thinking since the very first century. A Time CNN poll taken in 2002 found that 59% of Americans believe that the prophecies in the book of Revelation are about to happen, and nearly one quarter of them believe that the Bible predicted the 9/11 attack. And that explains why the best-selling books in America today are the 12 volumes known as the Left Behind series, written by the Christian fundamentalist Timothy LaHaye. By relating the words of the Bible to current events in the Middle East, he has prophesied a scenario that has captivated the imagination of tens of millions of Americans. And here's a sketch of it. Israel will shortly occupy the rest of the lands long ago given to it by God. It will then be attacked by legions of the Antichrist, presumably the Arab nations and Russia. This will lead to the final showdown, biblically known as the Battle of Armageddon. The Messiah will return for the rapture, the process by which all true believers will be lifted up from the earth and transported to heaven. And from their grandstand seat, they will watch the fate of all those left behind. For these latter will suffer years of tribulation, after which the righteous will enter heaven with the Son of God, while sinners will be condemned to eternal hellfire. Well, to all reasonably intelligent people living in the modern world, that whole scenario seems so preposterous as to be quite laughable. And we could afford to laugh it out of court if it did not have such serious implications. The people buying these books are the very ones who put George Bush back into the White House. And they also give strong moral support to Israel and the Jewish settlements on the West Bank. They do not fear any war with Islam, but on the contrary, welcome such a conflict as a necessary step on the road that will bring them final redemption. And they see the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan as warm-up acts, and Iran will be next. Now, that's the message that can be heard in the United States over 1,600 Christian radio stations and 250 Christian TV stations. And now comes the tragic irony. At the very time when the Christian community is being challenged to direct its energies to the ecological crisis, now looming as a present reality, its strong fundamentalist wing is giving its attention to a mythical global crisis expected 2,000 years ago. Now, it's alarming enough that fundamentalist Christianity has become such a significant force in the most powerful nation of the world, so much so as to endanger international peace. But worse is to follow. their vision of a coming Armageddon is blinding them and others to the real crisis we now face, the ecological crisis. And it is the misuse of the Bible that has led fundamentalists astray. Certainly the Bible records warnings by the ancient prophets, but they were not speaking to us, but to the people of their own day and time. And it's rather salutary to remember that Jesus rebuked the religious people of his day for failing, as he said, to interpret the signs of the times, so that it has been largely left to people outside of the churches to read the signs of the times today. Christian fundamentalists completely reject and even despise the secular prophets I referred to. They show no interest at all in the many environmental schemes now being initiated in an attempt to respond positively to the ecological crisis. And since the main body of Christian fundamentalists is present in the United States, it's no accident at all that this most powerful nation is not only endangering world peace, but rejects such international moves as the Kyoto Agreements. Their attitude is best illustrated by the example of the fundamentalist James Gaius Watt. He rose to be Secretary of the Interior in the Reagan administration, and he advocated that developers should be given access to the national parks and natural resources. He argued, I quote, "The earth is merely a temporary way station on the road to eternal life. It's unimportant, except as a place of testing to get into heaven. The earth was put here by the Lord for his people to subdue and to use for profitable purposes on the way to the hereafter." Well, that didn't stop with the Reagan administration. The administrator of the United States Environmental Protection Agency of the Environment has only recently declared that the re-election of President Bush now provides a mandate to relax pollution limits for ozone, to eliminate vehicle tailpipe inspections, to ease pollution standards for cars, to allow corporations to keep certain information about environmental problems secret from the public, and to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling. Well, such an attitude reflects Christianity at its very worst and in its most dangerous form. Traditional Christianity, however much it may bring comfort to the individual, shows little or no concern for the salvation of the planet. Thus, the two global catastrophes I have described are fundamentally different from each other. That envisaged by the fundamentalists lies solely in the hands of God, and all that humans can do is to passively accept the salvation offered by God. The ecological crisis is the result of human action, and only humans can do something positive about it. So if Christianity is to respond to the challenge posed by the scientists in their manifesto, it has to put its own house in order. And it must first reject completely the ancient expectation of a final Armageddon and a literal return of Jesus Christ. And then it must replace that by an appreciative understanding of the real crisis facing humankind, the ecological crisis. And it must make a positive response to it. And how can it do that? Well, as an American Catholic priest, Thomas Berry, has said, we must move beyond a spirituality focused simply on the divine and the human, to a spirituality concerned with the survival of the natural world in all its splendor and fertility and integral well-being. And in the lectures that follow, I'll try to sketch what such a new spirituality may entail. And that could be called the greening of Christianity.